late Hawaii Senator Spark Matsunaga used to wonder aloud why people and nations didn't put as much effort into waging peace as they did into waging war. He pursued his dream with all the zeal of a veteran who has seen war at first hand. It was fitting that his home state became the first in the United States to join more than 200 countries in celebrating the United Nations International Day of Peace and Nonviolence. 10 years ago, the state legislature's Act 23 read, September 21st of each year shall be known and recognized as Peace Day to promote peace programs, improve international relations, and increase educational awareness of peace. The milestone will be celebrated this coming weekend, and Jeannie Lum, editor of the international publication Journal of Peace Education and the coordinator of Peace Day Hawaii 2017, is with us in our studio. Hi, Jeannie. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Chris. I'm glad to be here.
You would think that, promoting peace, since that's the state of life to which we all aspire, would not necessarily be a struggle. You would think it would be the natural state of man, but seems to be in the opposite in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I think in a way it goes back, to the way peace education or peace studies was initiated anyway. The concept and definition of peace really came about as the absence of war, and it came out in the context of war. And I think that paradigm shift has been made since the Cold War ended, but it's not really aware in the public or collective consciousness of society as much. Right now it's not that peace is looking, when we think of peace, for example, as, the root causes of violence, and we've naturally come to that framework and looking at, well, what is peace in our lives? Really, the shift is about, well, how is peace part of what makes us human beings, and actually contributes to our potentiality of full development and full expansion of who we are as human beings and humanity in general. I think this shift and it's taken outside of the framework of war to what really the United Nations confirms as peace as the foundation for creating cultures of peace. How do we focus on those aspects of being human?
The notion of peace as the absence of war kind of gives permission to war as a natural state of humanity, doesn't it?
Exactly. And as a default for even thinking about peace, right?
Yeah.
The framework, for example, that we use in the Peace Day Hawaii framework is really the five aspects: peace, inner peace, peace in relation with others, peace with the environment, peace with all cultures, and peace and spirituality. And if you frame it in those broader categories, then peace really becomes part of how do we live our everyday lives and how do we build these relations for creating cultures of peace, as opposed to only looking at it, when a war arises or only when violence occurs. It's a very different shift.
Well, given that it's what presumably every man, woman, and child on the planet wants.
Yes, exactly.
It's pretty rare.
Yes. Well, do you mean the phenomena itself?
The phenomena of a peaceful life, living in peace.
Yes, yes. Well, I think the other question is, well, how do we then understand how we're living in peace? And, for example, now what's embraced within the peace movement and peace education are the sustainability goals. And part of the critique that goes with the sustainability goals is, well, what kind of culture have we been raised in the modern era? What kind of values are there? Highly competitive, seeking only profit for oneself. That these are part of the shift that has to be made in terms of the development of a sustainable mindset. And so in that respect, I think when you say people are not living in peace, we have to really, I think, look at the assumptions that we do live by, our beliefs and what we're just raised and socialized and have been born in and naturally kind of adapted by virtue that our society is that way. It's a real strong critique about where we are in the 21st century and where did we come from in the 19th and 20th century in terms of the values of the Industrial Revolution and all of those things that supported what is called in the United Nations language a culture of war. How do we shift from the values of a culture of war, which we have affirmed all this century, to, in fact, redefining and reconstructing and critiquing our way onto a culture of peace.
You're talking about a change in, a very fundamental change in human consciousness.
Yes, yes.
And historically, those have taken many generations to bring about.
That's the problem. I think, you know, we're only a few years, you know, they're identifying 2030 as, you know, the goal for becoming sustainable. You know, when you think of the already the generations, any era, historical era takes, and also the going backwards and forwards, you know, within those eras, you know, how can we make this happen? You know, I think that's...
Well, how can we? I'm listening.
Well, I always am rooting for peace education in the public school system, you know, different ways of approaching subject matters. And
what does that consist of, peace education?
Well, one would, for example, look at the discipline system in the public education system. It's and generally in many, I mean, it's punitive in approach. Mm-hmm. It's punishment as opposed to having people heal from being accosted or understanding violence or having it understood as a community, as a culture of the school, as a problem or issues surrounding the perpetrator and then the victim's healing process. Those things, for example, restorative justice as a approach to discipline where a whole school adapts it. And there's many schools in the mainland in different states which have tried it and been very successful in transforming their school cultures.
Are you optimistic overall?
I'm realistic. You know, I think it would be good. In Hawaii, actually, there's a lot of wonderful things happening, you know, on the sustainability path. I think how Hawaii is attempting to transform its own culture in that direction, I think it certainly could do more, especially in education, because that's where, you know, all of these beliefs and ways of being are challenged, if anything, or could be challenged.
Well, we'll check in with you from time to time in the future and kind of see how this effort is doing. Thanks very much for talking.
Yeah, thank you. I enjoyed it.
Jeannie Lum is editor of an international publication, the Journal of Peace Education, and is the coordinator of Peace Day Hawaii 2017, which will be marked with a celebration on Saturday, September 16th. From 2 to 7:30 p.m. at the Soka Gakkai International Cultural Center on Pali Highway in Honolulu. That's free and open to the public, and you can learn more on our Facebook page, The Conversation.
Aloha, I'm Alex Monty Fox from Mid-Pacific School of the Arts. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Two catastrophic hurricanes within a week of one another, an earthquake in Mexico, wildfires in the western U.S., and 100-degree temperatures in California, is it time to start thinking about climate change? With an apparent anti-science movement abroad in the nation and climate change denial making its way all the way to the EPA and the Oval Office, we saw an opportunity to sort fact from fiction and to find out what our listeners are thinking. We're hoping to hear from you with questions or comments on the subject of global warming at the number 941-3689 or from Neighbor Islands at 877-941-3689. Our guests are Dr. Steve Buesinger, chair of the UH Atmospheric Sciences Department, and Camilo Mora, associate professor at the UH Geography Department in the College of Social Sciences. Again, that number is 941-3689, or if you're on a neighbor island, 877-941-3689. Thanks to both of you for coming in. And let's maybe start by trying to understand, first of all, the evidence for climate change, and then the movement of climate change denial and try to understand how that has come about. But let's talk about the evidence for climate change, which has been accumulated for how long now?
Well, thank you for having us.
Sure.
This is Steve Buesinger. The evidence for climate change is actually very broad. It comes in a large variety of categories, like sea level rise, melting of ice sheets in the Arctic, glacier reduction, and then there's just increasing heat waves, increasing floods. And we can also bring a line that shows how extreme weather events have been impacted by climate change as well.
We've seen some extreme weather events in the last couple of weeks. Is it valid to make a comparison, make a connection?
A lot of scientists probably will tell you that they cannot say yes or not to that answer, to that question. I personally will say with 100%, 95% certainty that climate change will be shown to have some impact on these things that just happened recently. Mm-hmm. My argument for this is the fact that, as Steve pointed out, you have many elements of the climate, all of which are connected, right? Precipitation, heat, floods, all of these things are connected, and we had a driving force that is heat. Mm-hmm. We know that we are making the planet hotter by us producing CO2. So when you increase CO2, obviously you are going to cause all of these changes, all of which are going to be triggered by that heat. Obviously, these things have happened before, and you will probably hear a lot of climate deniers saying these things have happened before. How is it any different now? Well, the reason is that you are putting more heat into this equation. So this is like a baseball player making two home runs. You gave steroids to this baseball player. Now he makes four.
Yeah.
So how many home runs you can say are the results of the steroids? Two or four? Personally, yeah. I will say the four of them. Right now, even the two that he could do naturally are being impacted by the use of steroids. And that, in the sense of climate change, this is like a turning a hurricane 2 into a hurricane 4. Just the addition of this extra heat that you are putting there. So that is where I feel confident that even if climate change is not the whole responsible for this, it's what making these events much worse.
We've heard that comparison as hurricanes on steroids, right?
Yes, and it turns out that hurricanes are a heat engine. We understand the thermodynamics really well.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out if you increase the sea surface temperature by 1 degree centigrade, it will increase the winds in a hurricane by 8 meters per second, which is about 20 miles per hour.
That's very serious.
So that's a very clear relationship. And the other thing is that if you have a warmer sea surface temperature, you get more humidity in the air.
Mm-hmm.
And 1 degree warmer sea surface temperature at these warm temperatures that hurricanes thrive under means that you will have an increase of 7% in the vapor pressure in the lower atmosphere, and that's the fuel for the storm.
Now, I would like to add to that, though, so that people don't have to think about that you have to do a PhD to understand this. This hurricane Irma that just happened, it was a hurricane category 3 by the end of Cuba.
Right.
It went through the space between Cuba and Florida, and the ocean was warm there. And because of that additional warming of that ocean, that hurricane was classified again to a category 4. So you can see from there how the heat that was on that tiny piece of ocean made that hurricane going from a category 3 back to a category 4, just for people to appreciate how the ocean and the heat of the ocean makes these events much worse.
That's unusual, isn't it? Because my understanding in past hurricanes is that frequently when they pass over an area of open ocean, they get downgraded rather than upgraded. Is that not accurate?
Well, it's true that when hurricanes like a very nice symmetric environment, and
right.
if they pass over an island like Cuba, the wind flow gets disrupted, and that causes the storm to weaken.
Mm-hmm.
Hurricanes will weaken after landfall, so they like open ocean in that regard. But what's interesting in the case of a storm like Harvey, we had about half a degree warmer than average sea surface temperatures, and the fact that it came in as a Category 4 storm is I think, very noteworthy, because if the ocean temperature had been a degree or a degree and a half cooler, as it might have been back in the middle of the last century,
mm-hmm.
this storm would have come in at a Category 2 or a Category 3. So there is a difference in terms of, as sea surface temperatures rise, the potential for storms to be more intense is definitely real.
That's what Camilo just compared to steroids.
That's right.
Now, there's another factor with Harvey, and that's that it moved incredibly slowly. It just kind of stalled over Texas. Mm-hmm. And one of the predictions of climate change is that you will have a decrease in the westerlies and a northward movement during the summertime of the jet stream farther into Canada. And that leaves more high pressure and lighter winds over places like the Gulf of Mexico, mm-hmm. and the Caribbean, and even Hawaii. And recent research has shown that the maximum intensity of hurricanes is shifting gradually northward in time, and that's a trend that's expected to continue. And in particular for Hawaii, that's not good news, because most of the hurricanes that we see pass just to the south of the Hawaiian Islands, historically.
Right.
And if that track moves a bit northward, then the Big Island's going to see a lot more hurricanes approaching from the west. And we've sort of seen that already. In 2015, we had three Category 4 storms churning around the Hawaiian Islands. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have a direct hit, thank God, but because we are kind of a small target. But the writing's on the wall that we'll probably see as much as two additional hurricanes per hurricane season by the middle of the century.
One thing that I want to point out to that is the fact that all of these requires public attention. And I think that a lot of the lack of public attention has to do with the scientists and the media, in the sense that we always emphasize these things when they happen, just like we are doing right now. But people will forget these things by next week.
Yeah.
Just like we were talking about heat waves this summer, we don't talk about heat waves anymore. So we need to start remembering things. We'll suffer from a short-term memory loss, in the sense that these things are forgotten very quickly. And I like, Chris, what you did early on, when you point out how we went from a heat wave in the summer to a wildfire in the middle to now a flood to now a hurricane. People need to start remembering these things to realize that this is as real as it can get, and that the planet is the health of the planet is at stake on these things.
Well, we have this thing called the 24-hour news cycle, which kind of enforces short-term memory loss, because we quickly replace one memory with another. Let me just interject something real quickly. We want to hear from listeners, so let me give a phone number again. 941-3689. Are on a neighbor island, 877-941-3689, because this is something we haven't done before on this program, but we do like to hear from listeners. And here's a question from Walter Wright of Kaneohe. Well, Walter, let's bring you in on the line, and I'll let you ask your question yourself.
Hey, I'm here.
Hey. What's your question, Walter?
The question is whether or not the ocean warming in the Pacific is going to increase the intensity as well as the number of the hurricanes that might hit Hawaii.
Well, sounds as if we already, yeah.
But no, that's an excellent question. And certainly there's been a lot of research in recent times regarding the number of hurricanes that will be spawned in the future. And there is a debate on that question in general. However, for Hawaii in particular, we are in an unfortunate situation that the track of the hurricanes seems to be shifting northward, and so the climate models are indicating that we will see additional hurricanes in the future, specifically in Hawaii. That's not necessarily true for everywhere on the planet, and so far it doesn't seem as though the total number of hurricanes has increased. However, the most intense hurricanes has increased. So that's the climate change factor.
Again, this is another thing where the scientists, we should keep away from talking to the public about this uncertainty, though, because this saying to the people that we just don't know hasn't been shown. What it does to the general public is to believe that there is nothing there. Now, unfortunately, the debate that has happened at the scientific level is the fact that we had a huge variability on the frequency of these hurricanes. They happen all the time. So it's very hard for us as a scientist to claim that they had happened. Fortunately, is the way in which the question has been formulated. And the change that has happened is now to say that these hurricanes are happening one in a thousand, one in 100 to 1,000 years events now are becoming things that happen every 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for instance, the flood that just happened in Florida, in Texas.
So-called 100-year storms are now 10-year storms.
Exactly. So it changed the conversation from saying whether this is caused by climate change or not, is to say, well, yes, it's just like the asteroids. You mm-hmm. know, the example of the asteroids is a good example there, because the honron is always going to happen.
Steroids.
The asteroids.
Yeah.
But then you had this additional thing that pushed these things over the limit to make them either more extreme mm-hmm. or something that happens every 1,000 years to something that happens now 100 years to something that happens every 10 years.
Just to sort of put a little historical context into this, when did the phenomenon of climate change become measurable? When did this start affecting the planet? 20 years ago? 30 years ago? 100 years ago?
I would say that it became statistically significant above the variability in looking at the data probably about 30 years ago.
Yeah.
At that point, scientists were quite clear on the fact that there was evidence that global warming was starting to happen. I'd like to make a plea, though, that one of the things that because the news cycle is so short, but I wanted to give people a short list of things they can do at home in order to reduce their carbon footprint.
Mm-hmm.
And I can read this very quickly.
Okay.
And you can say, well, you know, these things are way beyond what I can do, so I'm just going to forget about it. But I think it's worth considering. Become a vegetarian, eat organic, buy local, live in the climate. Live in the climate means don't always expect to have 70 degrees in your house and your car and your workplace.
Don't crank your air conditioning.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Dry line your clothes. Vote with your feet. Reduce and reuse before you recycle. And you can also offset your carbon emissions. If you have to fly for your work, you can do things through the United Nations to provide some funding so that the carbon footprint is decreased elsewhere, such as buying solar power in India. Or
well, actually, you can do that here. By the way, here in the state of Hawaii, we have over 80% of the land completely damaged already, and we have different projects on site right now that will allow the individual people to go and, for instance, plant trees so that those trees will sequester that CO2 and as a way to offset the emissions that you had.
Yeah, that's excellent.
We have got a caller on the line. Billy from Haiku, Maui, has a question. I'm going to open up the line to hear his question.
Yes.
Hi, Billy. Go
Hello?
Ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder why people are focused on the environment, but I think they ought to know how to protect themselves from the environment by building, like, earth houses and dome houses. And not building on the beaches, which is eroding too.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're all connected. That's what I was thinking about. Okay. Aloha.
Yeah, thanks,
Thank
Billy.
I'd love to address that one. One of the things that's very clear to me is with this situation in Texas. Texas has this idea of protecting the low-lying areas with levees that fail. They're designed supposedly for the 100-year flood, but they end up failing every other year.
Mm-hmm.
So they clearly are not doing a good job. They have very poor zoning, too, allowing people to build in flood zones. If they were to really protect Houston and places like New Orleans for the 10,000-year storm, it would cost about the same as it does for the recovery of a couple of these storms. So an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
Mm-hmm. Well said. Another caller from Kahulu has a question. Charlie, you on the line?
Yep.
Yeah, what's your question?
Well, basically, it's like you're driving down the road, your whole family's in the car, and you're going at 100 miles an hour, and you don't know what the road is like ahead of you. So you just think, well, what's the odds that there's a lot of curves? Should I just keep going at 100 miles an hour and take the chance, or should I reduce my speed? And it's not like there's nothing we can do, so why take the chance? You know, the chances, the consequences are so dire. I don't know why, you know, a denier would even take the chance. That's what I don't understand about that mentality is, have people actually done psychological, you know, questioning of these people?
Well, Charlie, these people are a fairly sizable percentage of our population. But Camilo, what's your response?
That is actually something that worries me the most about climate change is the fact that we think that we're going to fix these things when we get there. Unfortunately, when we get there, it's going to be way too late.
Right.
Exactly because of what you are saying there. The actual scientific term for that is called inertia.
Yeah.
So, and the example that we normally use is like the Titanic is about to hit an iceberg. They saw it coming. They saw it. They had 15 minutes. They put their trolls back. They were moving sideways. But the speed at which they were going was so fast that they couldn't avoid that iceberg. Mm-hmm. Again, because the speed was too high. It's the same thing with climate change. We are heating up the planet at such a fast speed that once these things start cranking in, like heat waves, storms, floods, all of this stuff, it's just going to be way too late for us to dial back on this thing. Exactly. That's one of the reasons why I get so worried about it, exactly because of the thing that you point out there. We call it inertia of these changes.
You know, the sense that I get from your question is there's a lot of news out there that says that there's uncertainty. And the uncertainty is kind of like a fog, and you're in a car and you're driving through the fog, and the fog gets thicker and thicker, and you know that there's a cliff ahead, or you know that there's a bridge out.
Mm-hmm.
Shouldn't we slow down a little bit?
Mm-hmm.
And in this metaphor, the slowing down is doing things that are going to reduce our carbon footprint. And of course, the government ought to be first and central in this. In moving us away from fossil fuels and into renewables, but we can do a lot ourselves as well.
Well, but one thing about that you point out the government there, which is totally true, but I think that more importantly is the general people, because most countries around the world, you still had a democratic system in which is the people that chooses the governments. So, for instance, having a president like the one that we have right now that is destroying any policy protecting the environment and the climate speaks pretty loud, not about the president as much as he speaks about the people that elected that president. So I think that that's where we need to start realizing the limitations that we had to deal with if we want to make a big difference, is that we need everybody to start understanding and take these things more seriously, because that will determine who is going to be on government at the end of the day.
Again and again, we come back to education. And when you talked about inertia, I remember learning about that in eighth grade science, you know, an object in motion tends to remain in motion, etc. I wonder if kids today are learning about that at that age, because, you know, understanding science and the scientific method should, I would think, come pretty early in your education, because it isn't just what you're learning in science class. It's a way of thinking and a way of verifying information, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I would certainly second that, that education is very, very important in this endeavor. We all live on a very small island in space. The atmosphere is extremely thin, and you can go through half the atmosphere just basically by going to the top of Mauna Kea. That atmosphere is not able to take all of the pollution that we put in it without it having a pretty big effect. And so that's something that we just have to be responsible about.
Let me just interject something. A caller who didn't want to be broadcast live from Hilo recommends a documentary called Earth, the Operator's Manual. So that's something to keep in mind. A caller from Kona, Richard, asks why hurricanes go north before going. Oh, Richard, I'll let you ask the question.
Yeah, I lived here for a long time, 77, in a sailboat sailed over here. And we got acquainted with the island weather. And since then, we've watched storm after storm that used to go south of the Big Island, come from the east and basically go around the Big Island and then turn up towards Kauai or Oahu. And now, instead of doing that, it gets about two-thirds of the way over, and it starts veering up in about a 45-degree angle, most of them. And so that's the first question, why is that? Second question is, why does the I kind of imagined the Big Island as a barn, and if it was hard weather, you'd go to the other side of the barn where the
We're rapidly running out of time. We need to boil it down to a single question, because we've only got about a minute left, Richard. But
I think I can address these. Basically, the spin of the planet imparts the spin to hurricanes as well. It's mm-hmm. called the Coriolis force. And the Coriolis force does tend to make hurricanes move gradually in a northward direction away from the equator. You'll notice that hurricanes never cross the equator. So that's part one. Why hurricanes are tending to move in an easterly direction south of the Big Island and then turn, that could very well be because we have this Hawaiian high to the north of us in the summertime that pushes the hurricanes and keeps them south. They're on a easterly or the westerly track toward the west, and then as they pass the Big Island, there's a bit of slacking in the winds, and they turn more northward and hit Kauai.
Well, I wish we had more time, but I want to thank both of you for at least moving us toward a little further to an understanding of this complex subject, and thanks to our callers for calling in. Dr. Steve Buesinger is chair of the UH Atmospheric Sciences Department. Camilo Mora is an associate professor at the UH Geography Department in the College of Social Sciences. Thanks to both of you for being with us.
Thank you.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
Some of the most troubling evidence of global warming can be found on just about any coral reef, where human depredations have done some of the most visible and far-reaching damage. Scientists from around the world are working to reverse the dramatic die-offs of coral reefs and say their efforts could provide us with clues for our own survival. Nathan Eagle has more in today's Civil Beat Reality Check. Hi, Nathan. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Coral is a species that cannot be considered in isolation, right? I don't know if you'd call it a bellwether species or not, but the fate of a great many other creatures is tied up in the fate of coral, right?
Absolutely. I guess we could call it the canary in the underwater coal mine.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's actually a pretty good analogy, because as coral goes, so go a lot of things. But what can be done about this?
Well, a lot can be done, and a lot locally, and then a lot in a broader sense. So I talk to a lot of folks here on the ground that kind of at the forefront of the effort to save corals, essentially. Mm-hmm. I mean, we lost, half of them in the last 30 years worldwide.
Yeah.
So we've got scientists like Ruth Gates out at the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology, and Bob Richman over at Kauala Marine Laboratory, and others that are really getting down to it and getting to work on it.
What are they learning? What are the hopeful signs in their research?
Well, one of the hopeful things that Ruth Gates is doing with her team over there is they're breeding super corals. So they realized that in one of the last bleaching events that we had out in Kaneohe Bay, they found the same species of coral side by side. One of them bleached, one of them didn't. And they're like, well, this is interesting. Let's study this. Let's breed these ones that survived the bleaching. They must have something unique about them. And then breed them with more and create, like she calls them, super corals.
This sounds a lot like genetic modification.
It sounds like that, but it is definitely not genetic modification. As she likes to put it, it's assisted evolution.
Okay. What's the difference?
There's no splicing or any of the genes or anything like that. It's just kind of facilitating the process by which they're breeding, as opposed mm-hmm. to getting in there at the actual DNA level.
So assisting evolution means maybe changing the conditions around the organism and allowing it to react based on its genetic makeup, that kind of thing?
Yeah, that kind of thing. For instance, even with these corals that they're breeding, or the super corals, they're also putting them on what she calls environmental treadmills. You know, they're looking at future projections that show the ocean's warming and are just way too fast for them to adapt to. So they're putting them in the lab and then taking a look at, like, well, what can they withstand? And then, okay, some of these corals were able to tolerate a higher or warmer temperature, so let's breed them as well. So then maybe we can then plant them, and they'll be able to withstand these effects of climate change that are here and projected to come in the future.
Well, Nathan, this is an area in which we rarely hear an optimistic story, so this is most welcome. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring reporter Nathan Eagle.
Support for Stargazer comes from Urgent Care Hawaii, walk-in clinics in Pearl City, Kailua, Kapolei, and Waikiki. Featuring ZipPass, a new online tool to secure a place in line. AmazingUrgentCare.com. Stargazer Time, our weekly look at what's happening in the massive universe around our tiny planet, plus what we can look for in our dark island skies. And as usual, we are turning to the expertise of Christopher Phillips. Welcome back, Christopher. What do you have this week?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be back. So this week, stargazers, look out for the planet Saturn in the southwestern sky. It will set in the west around 8 p.m. The moon this week will be passing through its last quarter phase, marking a return of dark skies here in the island.
Now, you mentioned Saturn. You've got quite a landmark story related to Saturn this week, correct?
That's right. One of the most incredible journeys of discovery in the history of the human race will come to a fiery end in the skies above Saturn. The Cassini spacecraft will take one last look at this magnificent planetary system, then plunge headlong into the depths of the Saturnian atmosphere. This event will bring to a close a mission of exploration that has lasted almost 20 years. This Friday at 7 a.m. Eastern Time, Cassini will become legend.
The accomplishments of this mission have just been staggering.
They truly are. A lot of people forget when Cassini first launched, it had a hitchhiker in the form of the European Space Agency's Huygens probe. This probe would be the first to land on the surface of a gas giant's moon. The moon was Titan, and Huygens sent back breathtaking views of Titan's mountainous surface, its lakes of methane, and oceans of hydrocarbons.
And don't leave out Enceladus, Christopher.
Oh, yeah. Cassini was the first probe to fly through massive erupting clouds of water vapor from the tiny icy moon. And it gave us a tantalizing glimpse into the world beneath that ice, a world of perhaps of liquid water and an environment that may be suitable for life.
Hey, when this thing plunges, which is, again, 7 a.m. Eastern on Friday, that's 1 a.m. Hawaii time, is NASA running any kind of stuff online where folks can watch what's going on or no?
Unfortunately, this won't be a real-time experience, and Cassini will only have a few minutes to transmit the last critical bits of data before it burns up. And so, while we might like to see video and images, those files are simply too big for the probe to collect and transmit. But it will be transmitting other scientific data that will allow us to study Saturn's atmosphere as it travels through it.
And we'll look forward to a complete report afterwards from you, Christopher Phillips, and another exciting one here. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week for Stargazer.
Aloha, I'm Allison Yaffe from Manhattan, New York. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
There's a human story behind all the nuclear bluster we hear out of North Korea, but it's not an easy one to tell. When writer Adam Johnson set out to tell it, he used fiction as his vehicle. The result was his Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Orphan Master's Son, his account of life inside what Johnson calls the most voiceless place in the world, the ongoing cruel psychological experiment that is today's North Korea. Johnson's in town for an author's talk this evening in Honolulu. We spoke with him last week about the difficulty of sorting fact from fiction in Kim Jong-un's world.
The North Koreans are very bellicose with their threats and with the way they discuss things. One of the tricky things with dealing with North Korea is the fact that they have a single voice. It's a challenge to determine the audience. With a single voice, they speak to the people of North Korea, to the people of Pyongyang, to South Korea, to the region, to the world. And it's hard to disambiguate those.
And you have no alternative voice to compare.
That's absolutely true. In America, we have many different spokespersons. They speak in different forums. They alter their speech. They customize things. They say who they're speaking to, but
right. That's
not how the North Koreans do business.
Well, there's a whole, it's a cottage industry dissecting the nuances of statements from North Korea's leaders over the years.
Well, that's absolutely true. And I think they get a lot out of being cryptic.
Mm-hmm.
But, they're a tiny country. They're a very impoverished country. And yet, through a series of techniques like crypto communication, they've managed to be at the center of international conversations.
Yeah, having an impact out of all proportion to their size or population.
It's really an astonishing case study in that regard.
There's a pretty sophisticated understanding of how people think, how they react, how news media react. This is not random stuff, is it?
Well, it's difficult to cover North Korea and to talk about North Korea because, in the West, in the world of journalism, we have certain standards. Quotes have to be able to be confirmed.
Mm-hmm.
Facts have to be verifiable. You have to be able to research the place. And none of that is true for North Korea.
Yeah.
We can verify nothing.
Yeah.
And really all we have about the place are satellite photos and the testimonies of defectors, which are come from people who are traumatized, who probably only see a certain sector of North Korea. And the picture can only be made in aggregate. But as a novelist, I felt like I had an edge on journalism in, some regards. What the journalist cannot use is rumor, suspicion, nightmare, dream, fantasy. But to me, as a novelist, those are all very useful to help make a portrait of the psychology there.
Well, thinking back in my own days in journalism, there are always things in the newsroom that darn well to be true that you can't report, but know that's true. And that's where fiction has an advantage. That's exactly the response I had to your work, that you were using fiction to reveal to a nonfiction purpose in a number of ways.
Well, I also personally believe that all humans have the same sets of desires and needs that we're all fundamentally the same. When you talk to a defector, certainly they have had experiences that I've never had, but what startles you is how much you have in common. They want the same things in life, safety, security, opportunity, better future for their kids. All of these things are there. And if this is a place where people cannot get their humanity out, they can't create, they can't report, they can't articulate anything to the outside world, I kind of felt like maybe it was possible to project our humanity in if we do have an essential commonality.
Even in the most appalling stories of human suffering, humanity has a way of kind of shining through, doesn't it?
It does. And in appalling circumstances are opportunities for, altruism, sacrifice, and definition of humanity to come into a sharper focus than in normal life. And that terrain for a novelist, getting your characters to a place where they kind of must define themselves, is a place where you're going to make the richest human portraits.
Well, what happens to the human spirit when it's crushed, or at least attempts are made to crush it? How does life somehow emerge through that?
Well, it is certainly definitive. One thing I think about North Korea is this. We like in the West what I call the Sophie's Choice story, where humans have to make impossible decisions. And maybe once in your life you have to make one, or maybe not at all. But I do feel like everyone in North Korea is faced with a Sophie's choice, something impossible. Do I feed this child and not that child? Do I report on this person? Do I allow myself to be reported on? Do I make a stand and sacrifice everything or not? And so, it's a place where I believe there is a clear line between surviving and living. And, you know, in the West, we like to think of living as meaning having a meaningful life.
Yeah.
You know, something that's of your own identity and spirit. And sometimes there you have to choose.
Well, I would think so. And I would also think that given that the conditions that you describe have now been going on for generations, that there are people of age today who have never grown up in any other world except one defined by paranoia.
That's right. You know, here's, books mean a lot to us in the Western world. They certainly mean a lot to me. If you think about the fact that the Japanese began the colonial period by invading the Korean Peninsula in 1910,
mm-hmm.
and when they do that, they make Korean art illegal, like the gaegeum and the taegeum, like national instruments, became illegal. They began instruction in the schools in Japanese. Koreans had to take on Japanese names. Japanese or Korean theater became forbidden, and Korean books. And so starting in 1910, Korean books become inaccessible to Koreans. And in North Korea, you know, you have the colonial period, World War II, partition by the superpowers. You have the Civil War. And then in the North, more than six decades of a propagandistic regime where novels are illegal. And so in that place, no one has read a novel, as you and I would think of it, in over 100 years. And so your great-grandparent doesn't remember anyone who's read a book as we would know it.
Yeah. A complete overhaul of human consciousness for a society, I would think.
And what does it mean to be so divorced from your own identity, from your own Koreanness? 4,000 years of Koreanness have been erased by the Kim regime. And we won't really know what that, you know, means until, of course, the regime's gone and people are free to ask questions.
Your research for your novel, based in large part on defector testimony and mm-hmm. and on your own experience, but how difficult was it for you as a Westerner to get inside this admittedly extremely foreign mindset?
Well, I did travel to North Korea. I traveled there when Kim Jong-il was still in power. Mm-hmm. And, I know much more about Kim Jong-il than I have a sense of maybe Kim Jong-un. But Kim Jong-il loved money. He needed money, and he loved tourism. And he was a very kind of cunning, savvy person, and he had a very controlled way of bringing tourists in. It was difficult for me to go. You have to think of this place as like, there's no rule of law, and there are no institutions other than the whim of the dictator. And so if he says, hey, let's bring some tourists in and get some cash, well, then tourist season's open. And then the next year, no tourists. So you kind of just, it's catch as catch can there. But, you know, Kim Jong-un, you know, I can't really figure him out from my perspective. You know, I don't have a security clearance. But, you know, why imprison tourists? You know, that cost him so much money.
Yeah.
Why close the Kaesong Industrial Complex? That cost him $1 million a day. So I can't figure out his self-interest necessarily.
It's too easy to dismiss this as craziness, isn't it?
Well, you know, unfortunately, you know, it's so difficult to report on North Korea. It takes long, intensive portraits with tons of research. So it's easier for people to just say, oh, it's a place of madness, of evil or buffoonery. You know, we have these shorthand portraits.
Yeah.
Really, it's a place where 24 million people were unlucky enough to be born into. They're just as smart and funny and human and feeling and caring as we are. Yet they're just trapped under, like, a regime that's created the cruelest psychological experiment, like, ever dreamed up.
This is exactly where fiction can tell a story that nonfiction can only approach, isn't it?
Well, it's an interesting question. You know, I just became interested as a curious reader. I read a memoir of a defector, and it made me ask questions like, you know, I'm a father. I wondered what it would be like to be a dad there. And I'm a writer. I wondered what would I have to write there. And as I went looking for portraits of normal life in North Korea, I found them exceedingly rare. And I really think that for the people who make it out of North Korea, first of all, they're traumatized. And their stories, you know, don't come easily. They have survivor's guilt. The people who are left behind pay the price for their freedom. I think people who make it out often just want to look forward and not dwell on the past. They want new starts. And there's a lot of reasons why they don't tend to tell their stories. And I just was surprised at how hard it was to find portraits of, like, how people fall in love there, you know, what they have for breakfast.
Yeah.
And so I wondered if, even though I'm, like, a white guy from California and I'm not Korean, I asked myself many times, what am I doing writing this story? I also asked many times, like, why aren't more people trying to give voice to, like, the most voiceless place in the world?
Adam Johnson will speak this evening at a Books and Spirits event at Revolution Smart Home on Ward Avenue in Honolulu. And that's it for today's edition of The Conversation. Up tomorrow, we're going to look at the impact on 4 out of 10 Americans of the Equifax data breach and what we can do about it. We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments at this number, 808-792-8217. You also can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation. If you missed any of this show or want a past one, find them on the Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us tomorrow